Hello and welcome to another episode of Damn Interesting Week. We are so glad you've decided to join us. My name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And this was a Damn Interesting Week. So let's get started with our first link.
First link.
All right, from the BBC. This is a really beautiful story about how MND left a woman without a voice, but 8 seconds of scratchy audio gave it back to her. So this is one of those AI can do some good stories.
Huh.
So MND is known as motor neuron disease, and Sarah Ezekiel got this disease when she was only 34 years old. Now, previously, Sarah had been a very vivacious Londoner. She had been a personal assistant working in publishing when life took a turn. So she was married with her first child, who was then a toddler. The family was expecting a second baby, but she started feeling a little off. Her speech had been slowing and she felt a weakness in her left arm. And very unexpectedly, she was diagnosed with MND, which is also sometimes referred to as ALS.
Mm.
Now, this is a degenerative condition. It causes muscle weakness. And of the roughly 1,000 people diagnosed in the UK each year, the NHS says most will lose the ability to speak. It typically affects men more. It is life-shortening, but it does vary from person to person. And some people do live long lives. As for Sarah, she was in denial, thinking she would be fine when all of this got started. But after her second child was born, she deteriorated rapidly. So within months, she lost the use of her hands, then all intelligible speech, and her marriage ended soon after.
Dude, come on.
Yeah. As you can imagine, she was very depressed, terrified of disability and death, 2 tiny children to care for. She had to rely on 24-hour care, and she says it was really difficult to watch strangers care for her kids, but she was so grateful because that was the option that she had. So 5 years after Sarah's diagnosis, communication finally opened up with the advent of eye gaze technology. So it meant that she could build words and sentences with eye movements and speak, even though it was with that synthetic Stephen Hawking kind of voice. And best of all, she returned to her passion, which is painting. I didn't even know this was possible, but she uses the eye gaze technology to create original artworks, and it's gorgeous. I don't know how this could have been done with eye gaze technology, because it's like a portrait of a woman on a red background, but you know those paint pouring things where you have like a bunch of different colors of paint, and then you like tilt the canvas so it can pour in a certain way? It incorporates that. It's so beautiful, and I had no idea it could be done with this technology. So back in Bristol, we've got a Bristol-based assistive technology company called Smartbox, and Simon Poole asked her for about an hour's worth of audio to recreate her voice. So she and her adult children were like, okay, let's look for some footage, right? But Sarah lost her voice in the year 2000, and that was before smartphones were really widely used. So eventually they found an old VHS tape of when her first child was born. It was shot on a family camcorder in the 1990s, and it was a very amateur video. The picture was wobbly, the sound was distorted, they were drowned out by a TV that was on in the background really loud.
Wow.
So all they had were just 8 seconds worth of her voice. Quote, I thought there's no way we're going to be able to create a voice using audio that bad. But he played around with it. He looped it through the latest technology from international AI voice company 11 Labs. But the result was kind of thin. It didn't have a lot of intonation. And it had, according to the article, an American lilt, which, woo, if you're a vivacious Londoner, that's got to be a bit problematic. So he turned to another app where, using thousands of voices, AI had been trained to fill in gaps left by the isolator and to predict where a voice like Sarah's might go. So eventually, Simon ended up with a few audio phrases he felt happy with and sent them to Sarah. She told him that she almost cried upon first hearing her new old voice, and that one of Sarah's old friends, someone who knew what she used to sound like, was really impressed by how realistic it was. As for Sarah, she jokes that she sometimes misses her old synthetic voice. Quote, I was very posh and people didn't know I was really a Cockney with a slight lisp. But But she is happy to have regained her old voice. Quote, I am glad to be back. It's better than being a robot.
Yeah, I remember reading a thing where Stephen Hawking, at some point, they offered to give him a better voice. And he's like, nah, I've gotten used to this one. This one is me now. But
right?
You can absolutely see how not everybody would feel that way.
Yeah, I could also see someone who's like a deep scientist kind of embracing the robot voice for that.
Or can I get Jason Statham's voice?
Right, exactly.
I mean, pretty soon you probably can. You can probably license it out.
Probably you're right. Yeah.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article is from Scientific American, titled Why a Classic Psychology Theory About Vision Has Fallen Apart.
Oh.
So during her training in anthropology, Dorsa Amir, now at Duke University, became fascinated with the Muller-Lyer illusion. The illusion is simple. One long horizontal line is flanked by arrowheads on either side. Whether the arrowheads are pointing inward or outward dramatically changes the perceived length of the line.
Mm-hmm.
Most intriguingly, psychologists in the 1960s had apparently discovered something remarkable about the illusion. Only European and American urbanites fell for the trick.
Hmm.
When researcher Marshall Segal and his colleagues conducted the cross-cultural experiment, they came up with a hypothesis to explain the strange results. Difference in building styles. The researchers theorized that the prevalence of carpentry features, such as rectangular spaces and right angles, trained the visual systems of people in more wealthy industrialized cultures to perceive these angles in a way that make them more prone to the Muller-Lyer illusion. The carpentered world hypothesis took off. Psychologists tested other illusions involving straight lines and linear perspective across cultures and found similar results, suggesting that the culture or environment in which someone grows up could shape their brain's visual system and literally affect how they see the world. But it turns out that the story wasn't so simple.
No way.
Yeah. After connecting with Chaz Firestone, now a cognitive scientist at Johns Hopkins University, Amir learned that other studies of the Muller-Lyer illusion contradicted the anthropological explanations she had been given in grad school. The two researchers recently compiled a slew of evidence against this claim, publishing their argument in Psychological Review. For starters, the illusion still works when the lines are curved, or even when there are no lines at all and dots take their place, suggesting the illusion's effect isn't reliant on hallmarks of carpentry. Even more convincing, kids who have been blind their whole life and undergo lens replacement surgery are also susceptible to the illusion shortly after gaining sight. And even some animals, such as birds, fish, reptiles, insects, and non-human mammals, seem to fall for the trick. So, what explains the results in the seminal carpentered world studies? It's possible, or rather quite likely, that these are the results of research practices now recognized to be problematic by modern methodological standards, including discarding inconvenient data points and failing to conduct appropriate statistical tests, as Amir and Firestone wrote. Which is basically a polite way of saying you suck at science.
They were racist.
Even then, the results were highly inconsistent across the studies they found. But culture might affect how we see the world at a higher level. In a recent study, Michael Frank, a developmental psychologist at Stanford University, and his team studied perceptual and cognitive differences between people in the US and China. And the results were a mixed bag. The researchers found no strong cultural differences in the Ebbinghaus illusion, in which the perceived size of a circle is affected by the size of circles around it. But the scientists did find cultural differences in visual tasks that relied more on attention and interpretation. When Chinese participants were asked to describe an image they had just seen, they tended to describe the background more than the objects in the foreground, whereas US participants did the opposite. Frank explains, the tasks that yielded differences in our study tended to tap into linguistic descriptions and slow, effortful reasoning processes. Some cross-cultural psychologists point to Eastern collectivism and Western individualism to explain such results, but Frank remains agnostic. Similarly, Amir says that when tying a perceptual difference to a specific aspect of culture, such as carpentry or collectivism, researchers should think hard about what they are truly measuring and avoid making too many assumptions, especially those that involve cultures outside their own. Some initiatives are attempting to do just that. Frank and his colleagues began the Learning Variability Network Exchange, or LeVante, to improve cross-cultural comparison of learning and cognition across development. He also participates in large team science initiatives, such as Many Babies, that bring together research groups from around the world to share methods and data.
Many babies.
Yeah, it does not explain why it's babies.
I mean, they do study babies. Maybe these are specifically baby studies.
Or they're just like the science are their babies, bringing them together or something.
My brain went to Muppet Babies. So that's all I was thinking.
So Frank says, critically, in all of these efforts, there is local representation. Meaning that the research team includes individuals from the groups being studied.
Yeah. If you're eliminating data points, you're already off the beaten path and not worth following.
Get back on the path, bro.
Exactly.
Next link.
Next link.
This is from neuroscience.news.com. Radio waves can strengthen sense of smell. Yeah, many people, especially after COVID and aging or brain injury, suffer from a loss of smell. Mm-hmm. And there are very few effective treatments, and those that exist often use strong scents or medicines that cause discomfort in the patients. So in the study, the team asked volunteers with a healthy sense of smell to sit while a small radio antenna was placed near but not touching their forehead. For 5 minutes, this antenna gently sent out radio waves to reach the smell-related nerves deep in the brain. Before and after the short treatment, the authors tested how well the patient could smell very faint odors, like diluted alcohol or really faint fruit scents. They did this using pen-shaped odor dispensers called, a very official name here, Sniffin' Sticks.
Oh, no.
Literally an apostrophe on the end there.
Yeah.
They also recorded the patient's brain signals to see how active their smell nerves were. The team found that their method improved subjects' sense of smell for over a week after just one treatment.
Hmm.
The study represents the first time that a person's sense of smell has been improved using radio waves without any physical contact or chemicals, and the first attempt to explore radio frequency stimulation as a potential therapy for neurological conditions. So the result of the current study, which focused on people with a normal sense of smell, could help professionals such as perfumers, chefs, or coffee tasters who need to distinguish aromatic subtleties. Or for Disney.
So they haven't actually tested it on people with damaged senses of smell yet. They've only said normal people can smell better?
Correct.
Okay. Well, fingers crossed, but...
Yeah, that's why I honestly see it used for more nefarious purposes than good.
Yeah. Especially because it doesn't actually even have to be touching you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anytime they're like, hey, could you stand in front of this wall real quick so we can do facial recognition? And it turns out they've been shooting radio waves at your smell center of your brain.
And other parts of your brain. Like, it's got to go through other parts of your brain to get to that smell center. So what is it doing to that?
So if we know that radio signals can affect your olfactory senses just by resting in front on your forehead, what does it mean to wear Meta glasses?
Or a cell phone next to your face?
Right. Mm-hmm.
We'll find out in 70 years.
Yeah, when it's far too late for any of us to
do anything about this. Exactly. That's exactly right. All right, next link.
Next link.
All right, next up, we've got one from Nautilus called How Skinks and Honey Badgers Fight Cobra Venom.
Oh.
So perhaps not surprisingly, we are in Australia for this new study because that is where all of these horrible animals live. But they didn't always live there. It was about 30 million years ago when elapid snakes, which is the family that includes cobras, sea snakes, tiger snakes, and hundreds of other venomous terrors, first migrated into Australia from Asia. And from there, they spread rapidly across the continent, largely because the existing wildlife in Australia was behaviorally and chemically naive, meaning they had no strategies to protect themselves from this new type of predator. According to Brian Fry, a professor of toxicology at the University of Queensland, quote, it would have been absolute carnage.
Hmm.
But evolution did what it does best, and a particular mutation began to arise in the ancestors of, for example, mongooses, who are today one of the few successful predators of this type of snake. Now, the way cobra venom normally works is by hacking the victim's nervous system, specifically when it comes to muscle commands. This generally results in paralysis, inhibiting their ability to escape, or in the worst cases, to even breathe. And the thing is, even if a mongoose fully gets the drop on a cobra and kills it without getting bitten, it's still going to eat the cobra, which means it has to ingest the venom one way or the other. So the mongoose has developed a particular mechanism in its body that releases a sugar called N-glycosylation, which physically blocks the cobra toxins from attaching to the nerve receptors. But the interesting thing about this mutation is that N-glycosylation is actually the way that cobras internally protect themselves from their own venom. Hmm. And Fry says this is a classic example of the idea that there are a limited number of evolutionary good tricks, which is to say that faced with the same selective pressure, the same solution is going to independently arise in many different species. We also know, for example, that honey badgers use N-glycosylation to survive venomous snake bites. So given that we knew of at least three animals that already do this, Fry and his team hypothesized that maybe other creatures in the Australian outback secretly have this skill as well. So they decided to look at skinks, which, if you've never seen one, they basically look like a snake with legs.
Oh.
And the fun thing here, which we don't always get to say, is that they didn't have to use live specimens to test their hypothesis. So no skinks were harmed in the making of this study. Instead, they used tissue samples from museum specimens to create a model of the nerve receptors of Bellatorius freri, or the major skink. They then subjected the nerve model to the venom of the Pilbara death adder and confirmed that, yes, indeed, this particular skink is capable of releasing N-glycosylation. With that success in hand, they applied the same method to a bunch of other species of skink and confirmed that almost a third of them have this same ability. Along the way, they discovered that the genetic mutation in question comes down to a single amino acid change, which does help explain why so many different creatures have so readily happened upon it. But it also means that it wouldn't necessarily be that hard to genetically modify anything to be immune to cobra attacks. And that obviously has a lot of implications for areas where both livestock and humans are regularly terrorized by this type of snake. Because, you know, maybe we're not ready to start genetically modifying babies for this trait, but we definitely might do it for livestock because that's worth money, y'all.
Mm-hmm. It's so interesting that they used museum specimens because when you said that, I just had in my mind like some animal from like decades ago that hasn't been exposed to the kind of environmental pollution and conditions we deal with now.
Right, so, right.
I mean, I hope it's still relevant.
I mean, I would assume it has to have been preserved like in formaldehyde because you can't take a taxidermied animal and take a DNA sample from it anymore, surely. Maybe you can. I don't know.
Well, let's ask AI. I'm sure that'll yield a great conversation.
I mean, it's worth noting the skink did die initially. They're just relying on older abused skinks rather than newer ones.
Yeah.
All right. Next link.
Next link.
All right. From the New York Times. These majestic seabirds never stop pooping. That's right. We are talking about streaked shearwaters. They are called streaked shearwaters. And we're going to start off with some scientists who attach video cameras to animals, because they're usually seeking a creature's eye view. But when a researcher named Leo Uesaka stuck tiny cameras to the bellies of streaked shearwaters, he turned those cameras around. So maybe what he captured wasn't surprising, but the amount of it was. Quote, the frequency of the excretion is far more than I expected. Now, it's not as if his expectations were willy-nilly. Dr. Uesaka is a behavioral ecologist at the University of Tokyo, and he had intended to study how the seabirds run along the water surface as they take off in flight. But when the number one thing he noticed in his recordings was number two, fabulous writing there, he decided to shift his focus, and he learned that streaked shearwaters almost never defecate in the water. But they go more than 5 times an hour on average while flying. Most of the 15 birds he recorded went every 4 to 10 minutes, which is more often than any other seabirds that have been studied. And by keeping some of the birds briefly in a cardboard box and collecting their guano, the researchers estimated that streaked shearwaters excrete 5% of their body mass every hour, which is kind of astonishing.
I had a friend like that.
I'm going to confirm the name with you after we finish recording. Curiously, though, the birds almost never did their business while resting on the water. So the authors are speculating that the birds might be trying to keep their back ends clean, or maybe even avoid tipping off predators, or maybe just pushing out guano while floating is just not as comfortable. Additionally, sitting on the water might also make them lose body heat. But all of those loads of guano dropping in the ocean, they're more than just waste, because seabird guano contains nitrogen, phosphorus, and those act as fertilizers wherever they fall. For example, coral grows twice as fast around islands with seabird populations than around neighboring islands with few seabirds.
Hmm.
As Dr. Uesaka continues investigating seabird stools, he's now attaching small GPS devices to his subjects along with the cameras. That way, it'll show him whether the birds are concentrating their excretion over a certain part of the ocean so they can study those effects. And he also wants to repeat his research with other birds. But ultimately, Dr. Uesaka hopes that he has revealed a new way to use video loggers in research. Apparently, the most forward-thinking investigation might be a rear view. Listen, the New York Times gets a lot of guff, but talking about a poop article, they really danced around this with a lot of diplomacy.
Yeah, I appreciate their skill. It's good stuff.
All right, next link.
Next link.
This article comes to us from New Atlas. It's a bummer.
Oh. Yay.
Yeah. Red meat wreaks havoc on gut and drives inflammatory bowel disease.
Yeah.
Man.
Yeah. Which, you know, if you've been paying attention to this kind of stuff, it's not that surprising.
Yeah, but I still don't want to hear it. Like,
right. So a new study has produced strong evidence that red meat consumption is a trigger for inflammatory bowel disease, or IBD, demonstrating how it alters gut bacteria and immune activity in ways that worsen inflammation. In the animal study, mice were fed three types of red meat, pork, beef, and mutton, every day for 2 weeks. Then the researchers triggered colitis, a model for IBD, using a chemical called dextrin sulfate sodium, or DSS. Compared to mice on standard diets, those fed red meat developed more severe inflammation in the colon. Analysis showed a significant decrease in good bacteria genera and a spike in potentially damaging ones. Specifically, Akkermansia, Faecalibacterium, Streptococcus, and Lactococcus species saw a drop-off compared to the guts of mice on standard diets. Akkermansia helps maintain the gut's protective mucus layer and calms inflammation. Faecalibacterium produces butyrate, a critical fuel for colon cells and an anti-inflammatory. And Streptococcus and Lactococcus are important for good digestive and immune system health. Meanwhile, potentially bad bugs, Clostridium and Mucospirillum, became more abundant. These microbial shifts can disrupt the gut barrier, heighten immune reactivity, and amplify inflammation, especially in people already prone to IBD. But this wasn't the only change. After 2 weeks on the red meat diet, the mice had a larger amount of immune cells, especially neutrophils and macrophages in the colon. Under normal circumstances, the colon has a highly regulated immune system, so this increase suggested that immune cells had flooded there to fight injury or irritation. And too many of these two first responder cells can trigger a type of biological collateral damage, releasing enzymes and reactive modules that break down otherwise healthy tissue. This loop then results in a more inflamed and damaged gut lining. The mice showed signs of increased tissue damage, swelling, and signs of pain, and their gut lining broke down more easily. These results demonstrate that red meat, which was the only variable introduced to the mice, caused a direct and measurable biological change, and the impact was replicated across the three different kinds of meat. However, there were still limitations to the study. As well as it being a mice model, it was also a high-exposure study and one that only lasted 2 weeks.
Yeah, right? Like, maybe if they went 4 weeks, all of a sudden those negative health, they all become positive.
Yeah, you just gotta, like, horseshoe theory it. You just loop around.
Yeah, yeah. No, if I'm throwing my entire cognitive bias at this, I want to believe that they gave them the cheapest meat they could, and it was all corn-fed, and that if you use grass-fed beef, then maybe it's fine. This is what I tell myself.
I mean, at the very least, I bet that helps.
Mm-hmm. Probably. I mean, you could see how it might be true, and that's why I choose to believe it.
Mm-hmm. When I think it's the everyday eating of it, too, right? That's not something we did even as the, what do they call it, the paleo diet, right? Where they're like, eat meat all the time. It's like, they didn't do that. It was like once a week they would get meat.
Yeah,
it
if you were lucky,
much.
You hunted
if you were
something.
Lucky, yeah.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that is all we have time for today. We're so glad you've joined us. Some of the articles we did not have time to get to today include how a mysterious particle could explain the universe's missing antimatter, jelly ice is a weird new kind of ice that never melts, and cloning came to polo, then things got truly uncivilized. So all that and more, plus everything we talked about today, can be found on damninteresting.com. If you like our podcast and want to support us, you can do so at patreon.com/damninterestingweek. In the meantime, my name is Jennifer Lee Noonan.
I'm Angela Epley.
I'm Waisper Chen.
I'm Bradley Calhoun.
And we hope you have a damn interesting week. Bye-bye.